Welcome, everybody, to Trapping Radio. This is your host, Clint Locklear, the original Trapping Radio podcast. And if you're new to the show, we're going to talk about a lot of different things. We're going to be looking at this from the views of me. And just if you don't know what that means, we're going to go into the dark recesses of a lifelong entrepreneur, professional trapper, and partially uncivilized human being in today's world. And we're going to talk about all kind of stuff about putting fur in traps and different things like that. So hold on, I think we'll have a good time. My wife this morning read me something off the news that I was left speechless, and then I laughed, and then I was like, that is freaking awesome. You know, like when you pull up Google or whatever she was pulling up, and I guess because I've been watching the news, I've been at the FTA, which was a great show, guys. That was the model for someone to run a big show. The boys in Virginia, they kicked butt. It was organized. It was ran professional. It was not a drama queen fest. It did so well. I'm so proud of them. I almost wish they'd put together a course and help all the other people out there run conventions. They did a great job at marketing. They did a great job at advertising. They were super helpful. It was amazing. And so I want to thank everybody at the FTA and the boys in Virginia that put that on. Y'all got a great, great deal. But I was at the FTA, so I didn't, you know, I hadn't seen the news, and I've been back home, and we're in federales mode, which is massive amounts of bait, putting them in bottles and mixing them up, preserving it and adding the liquids and all that type stuff. And it's just, I haven't really watched any news. So it's been like 2 weeks. I have no idea. But apparently, there was some form of Democratic debate, I guess, from what Trump said. And he came out in the newspaper by saying he won the debate. How freaking amazing is that? You talking about, I bet the Democrats were screaming, Trump wins the Democrats debate. He wasn't even in it. Basically what he is saying is, I'm so good, I'm doing such a good job in this country, I've got such better ideas, I didn't have to be at the debate, and I won the debate. That was, I mean, when is the last time we've seen a grown man as president have a set of cojones that big and that much self-confidence to do that? Now, was it childish to say that? Maybe. But you know what? That's apparently all the news is talking about. So he wasn't even at the debate, in the debate, speaking the debate. And now Trump is all people are talking about whatever this debate was. I don't know who was in it. Really don't care. I can get all I need to get about what they're going to be talking about by looking at the Communist Manifesto and, you know, the origins of socialism and Marxist of communism. So why am I going to watch one of their debates just to see how bad they want to beat each other in being progressives? But Trump won the debate. That is so, that is a master of the media right there. Proud to have him as president. We had a Man Strong yesterday that, if you have not listened to it, guys, it's Man Strong 11. It's how to become mentally tough and how to get off the toilet with dignity. If you have not listened to that, I really wish everybody would, because a lot of that would apply to trapping. If you're trying to take yourself to places that you're not sure quite how to go in it, because mentally tough is one of those things that cannot be bought, read about, watched in a video, or go to a seminar, you earn it. So if you're interested in that type of thing, check out the Man Strong podcast here on Trapping Radio, episode 11. To be really, really cool. Now, I did a post on Facebook today, which is just having a little bit of fun. I finally got in my Farmer's Walk bars. And what these things are 4-foot bars with a handle that comes up like a U in the middle, so it's centered, and you put weight on both ends, and it's a very complicated exercise because you just put weight on there, you pick it up, and you take off walking. That's all it is. That's all it is. And I got them in, and I put on 45s on each end of that thing, so it's about 120 pounds. I had that in each hand, and I just took off walking in the yard. Got about 60 yards. When I got to the other end, this is what came to mind. Dang it! Why didn't I know about this about 30 years ago when I was doing all that beaver trapping? Because you want to know what this reminded me of? Beaver trapping. How many of you, if you're beaver trappers, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you're, keeping the animals, you're definitely going to know what I'm talking about. And if you do any type of ADC work, you know when you go somewhere and you've got to catch beaver, it's on the farthest part of the property. You're not allowed to drive because you're going to get stuck or run up somebody's field. And they want the beaver out of there. They don't want you to leave him in there. So you're going to drag him, big old bastards, back. And it is a fight almost to the death sometime to get them things out of there. And if you've never done it, let me explain what it means to be a beaver trapper. Because when Charles Dobbins used to talk about what you need to be a good beaver trapper is a size 5 hat and a size 55-inch chest. What he meant is, it is some physical friggin' work. And I can remember from doing this exercise with these farmer work balls today, what that was like. I'll never forget. I went to a place in North Georgia, and it was a guy's farm that there was a creek with easy access on the road, and it flowered out about 3/4 mile out through his farm in this great big old massive swamp. And he said, no one's ever trapped it. Now, you always hear that when you're going to do these jobs, but most of the time that's not true. This could have been true. And the first little dam at the road had a great big old crossover, so I set a 330. Then I go down about 50 yards, and there's another great big dam, and I set 2 or 3 crossovers. And I repeated this process over and over and over again. And this ground was sloppy. It's the kind that, you know, sucks the hip boots off of you. It was hot. It was not in the dead of winter. I don't remember if it was early fall or late spring when I did it. I don't think it was dead summer, but it was hot. And that morning, he wanted all the beaver out of there. That was the agreement, because he didn't want them smelling up and buzzards and all that type stuff. I thought, you know, maybe go in there and catch, you know, 5, 10, 15 beaver, you know, over the course of 4 or 5 days or whatever, and he'd be happy, I'd be happy, I'd be on my way. No, that's not the way this worked. My first check, I had 14 beaver. Not a single one of them was under 60 pounds. That's not an exaggeration. That's probably actually cutting the weight down a little bit, guys. I had to drag them things out of there. So you only got 2 arms, and I had a backpack, and you can only fit 70 pounds in a backpack of a beaver. And he didn't want that stuff left in there. So I had to make trip after trip after trip carrying 3-4 beaver out of whack. Sometimes them really big ones, one of them actually weighed 81 pounds because we weighed it. Its tail on there was about 17 inches wide. Dragging them things out. I was like a dog getting ready to go through an electric fence going back the next day, because that was extremely high on the misery scale. You talking about the suck one that day. I couldn't hold on to the beaver with my grip anymore. My traps and upper back and shoulders were screaming. My lower back was hurting. Everything was going wrong. That's what beaver trapping is. If you do that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Now, wouldn't it be a little bit better, guys, if you didn't have to go through the highest suck rating in the world to get that stuff done? If you're into beaver trapping, do yourself a favor. Look up Titan Fitness online. order some Farmer Walk bars. They're about $85. Get you some collars so the weights don't fall off the end. That's another $20. And then find you in Craigslist or something some 45 plates, or go down to Academy because they're not that expensive. And, you know, so and get where you can carry a 45 and maybe a 25 plate on each end and be able to walk that thing 60, 80, 100 yards. You ain't going to like it, but you will enjoy your trapping much better if you do it. I have no doubt about that whatsoever. So it's not like you're going through first day of boot camp when you're trying to drag these beaver out. Your body's already used to it. You'll have grip strength by doing the farmer's walk that you can grab a hold of a wet, slimy, muddy beaver's foot and drag that thing because you're going to have crushing power with your grip. And when someone comes up, and we've all met these people where you go to shake their hand and they try to, you know, show their manliness by just squeezing the snot out of it and hold you. If you do the farmer's walk for a couple of months and you get up into some weight, that's the last thing they're ever going to want to do to you. So, my post was kind of interesting, I thought, because it was just being me cutting up. A new member of Predator Control Group, and I have a picture of that on Facebook. And I was like, are they a boy or a girl? Because they bring misery and happiness. They cause a lot of emotion. They can make you feel like a man, and they can destroy your manhood all at the same time. And I said stuff like this, and really, the only thing people want to know is where to get them. But we got that today. Travis, little stud muffin, dude. Boy's done gained like 20 pounds, been working out, eating like a fiend, doing all that type stuff. I'm so proud of him because he's been wanting to really get at this for a long time. He's gained, I think it's 20 pounds. And you can tell. And he was nervous when he grabbed these things because in the pictures, they don't look that big. But when they got 245 plates on each side and this bar is 4 foot long and the grip on there is not as small as a regular bar, so you got to really use your hands to grip hold this thing. There's no knurling, so that it's just smooth metal. I had to go almost push, threaten, talk him into doing these things. And when he did, I could tell he actually enjoyed it. And he thought he's only going to be able to do it a few feet. Little stud muffin Travis Johnson. Probably the first time he's ever done anything like that in his life. Took him, I don't know, 40 feet, 50 feet and brought him back. So I'm hoping he does that every day for next month or so. And then I guarantee you he's going to have a strength difference like he's never seen before. But if you're a beaver trapper, think about getting some Farmer Walk handles, guys. Your life will be so much more enjoyable when you're in there. You know, just getting in shape for trapping is not a bad idea. I want to thank our sponsors. We got some of the best sponsors in the industry. We got sponsors that I've highly vetted, that I've worked with for years. These guys I trust. I do business with them all the time. I buy stuff from every single one of them, and I've always been satisfied. And when I talk to other people that use them, it's the same story over and over again, how good they are. We have F&T Fur Harvesters out of Michigan. We have Funky Trap Tags and Supplies out of Iowa. We've got Wildlife Control Supply out of Connecticut. And the way them crazy people keep adding taxes, I may be saying Wildlife Control Supplies in a different state in one of these upcoming years. Because I think Andy, if I understand what Andy Hewitt said, they had 56 new business taxes added in Connecticut in a week. Wow. Holy cow, could you imagine trying to keep up with the paperwork on that? We have Dunlap Lures, which is a good friend of mine, Jeff Dunlap, makes awesome lures, famous Hellfire lure. And we have Oki Cable and Trap out of Oklahoma, great guy, fur buyer, supply dealer, likes making wheel deals, likes to wheel and deal. All these guys, if you're looking for stuff, they pay for trapping radio. So give them a shot before you spend your money somewhere else. It's just kind of the manly thing to do, because if you partake content, this is a way that you can get what you want, help support me, and not have to like just give me money. So this the reason I like this a whole lot better than asking for money or some other form like that. Now, a lot of y'all have seen my video that I put up before the FTA where it shows a new product. I want to talk about that briefly. It is Federale's bait solution. That's going to be a big seller because at the FTA, I was amazed at how many of those that I sold. Probably, I guess, just from that video, these guys were looking that out. This is not a new product like something I've come up with. This is the same exact, down to the microgram of what I make Federales with. So when I grind it, when I'm grinding and preserving and adding glycerin to all this meat, and I throw sodium benzenoid in there, Federale's bait solution is what I make in big batches, and that's how I make Federale's bait. Now, all of y'all have used it. You know what it does out on the trap line. It's $14 a pint. In the day's world of trapping, that is definitely not an expensive bait. The Federale's bait solution is $29. It comes in a 16-ounce bottle. You mix that with a gallon of bait. That'll save you about $110 a gallon of use. See, I'm making a trade with you on it. As I get older, I seem to get a little lazier on certain things, and it's getting harder and harder to come up with the volumes of meat because of the volumes of Federales that we make and sell. So I am going to try to get a certain percentage of my customers to switch over to the bait solution, where they can use their own meat, and that'll save me a lot of effort throughout my year. And I'm willing to lose that money to do that. Now, the Federale's bait solution is $29. A pint of bait is $14. You get a gallon out of the solution. You get 16 ounces out of the jar. So if you're going to be using more than a pint or two, you might want to think about this. Now, you can't buy this right now today, and here's the reason. Well, I'll take that back. You probably can from F&T. If you call up F&T, I don't know if it's on their website yet. I believe they have theirs already at their place. Alan from Funky Trap Tags and Supplies ships my stuff. He went from the FTA where he got his first big load of it, then is now, as we speak, because this is Friday, at the Pennsylvania Trapping Association at their convention. And he's set up there. So he's got it. So if you're going to the show, he's got it. But it's not on a store yet. And I can't put it on my store till he gets back to Iowa so it's on the shelf. So when you order it, it'll be shipped to you because he's got the stock. But you can use any meat you want. It's got sodium benzenoid already in it. It's a simple process. You pour it into a gallon of bait, which can be beaver, bobcat, horse, house cats that have been ran over, snakes, pocket gophers, groundhogs, pork, deer, beef. It's not really going to make a difference. I say on the video, because I have so much faith in the bait solution, that you can probably just go get a great big old stick of bologna, grind it up to a gallon volume, throw this in here. After about 2 weeks, go catch your coyotes on bologna. Because this stuff rocks, as most of y'all know that you use Federales. So if you're going to be doing a lot of predator stuff this fall, and you're going to need more than one or two pints, you might want to think about the bait solution. Just saying, it's totally up to you. Some people don't want to do that little bit of extra work. Some people, for an extra, what would that be, $100, will be glad to do a little bit of that extra work. So just leaving that up to you. Of if you're a Federale's customer, how you want to deal with that. Now, before we get into the trapping tonight, I want to talk about a couple of other little bitty things. That one is the NTA. It's coming up. It's not that far off. It's in Springfield, Missouri. If you're going to be up there, make sure you stop by the booth and say hi. If you enjoy Trapping Radio, or if you're a member of the Trapping Radio Fur Brigade, where you get discounts with different companies, remember, if those guys are there, they're going to probably honor that. I know Alan will and I will. But come by and say hi. And please, when you see these sponsors, tell them that you appreciate them sponsoring Trapping Radio. Because, see, if no one ever talks to them and tells them that, they don't know that it's really making that big a difference, and why should they spend the money? So it's kind of a team effort here of what I'm trying to get you to do. So if you see F&T or Wildlife Control Supplies or Okie Capelin Trap or Jeff Dunlap, Funky Trap Tags and Supplies, just, you know, you don't have to, you know, do a big long speech. Just go, I really appreciate you sponsoring Trapping Radio. It means a lot to me, and it'll mean a lot to them because they're actually spending money. So just keep that in mind. The other thing that me and Cindy joined a shooting club not that far back. And it was, used to be all shotguns, and that's what we went up there for, is to play around with skeet one afternoon, just kind of a date type thing. And they've changed over this club to be more tactical. If you're looking for something to do in the summer and you want to go have fun with the family, guys, there's a thing called steel shooting. They're held all over the country every single weekend. Somehow it's like an organization. There's like a, you know, they've got these abbreviations, which is, this is not it, but it's like IPPA or something like that. And everybody that in the country, or maybe the world, that shoots on this thing goes into a database, and you have winners at the individual clubs, and you'll have national rankings that compete with everybody in the country because it's a neat sport. You can use 22 pistols and 22 rifles, like ARs or like a Ruger 10/22. That's what I'll be using, because they won't let me use my 308 at 15 feet on a steel plate. I don't blame them. You can use 9mm, 45s, 40s, 357s. You can use, I saw all kind of guns. It is not like you see on TV. At the local gun clubs, it's a bunch of guys that get together and have a good time. So you shoot these targets, and I think there's 8 stations, if I'm not mistaken. Everyone in the country set up at the same distances with the same size plates at the same distances apart out in the lane. So, you know, some are close and some are far away. Some are more spread out, and it's a very simple thing that they do. You have one of these plates that's on a stand. It's got a red marker on it. You can shoot any of the other plates you want in any order you want. And when you done shot the other plates or you're done, you shoot the one with a little red marker on it, and that stops your time. They've got the little counters, and it goes beep, and you draw your pistol or you pull up your 22 rifle, and you go through the course. Most of the time, the course is only taking, you know, some of the really fast people, 2.5 to 3 seconds, and then some it's like 15 seconds. There, what I was amazed at, there was no pressure, there was no egos, there was no anything. Guys were helping out other guys. Guys were talking about sights and ammo differences and everything. It's pure, clean fun. I saw kids doing it. The best person at the range was a female. And all these other guys, there were survivalists there. There were policemen there. There were just a bunch of bubbas there. And everybody was having a good time. It was freaking awesome. So if you're looking for something to do, because, you know, as we get older, you know, you get tired of going to the movies and going out to dinner, and mama wants to be treated special. If you've got a wife that likes to shoot, or even somewhat likes to shoot, I bet if you get in that environment, only thing I can say is it's going to start costing you ammo. Because in a Saturday, you're going to shoot, I think they said, 238 rounds. You know, 45s, that could be a lot more expensive than 9mm, and that's a lot more expensive than 22s. Most people are shooting 22s. And it's just a lot of fun. So I'd have thought I'd bring that up to you, because me and Cindy's probably, I don't know if I'm going to get her to do the shooting like that for a while, but I know she's pretty competitive. And if I can get her to do it once, she'll be hooked. Now, what is a better way for a family in the United States of America to have on a Sunday or a Saturday afternoon than to go shoot a bunch of steel plates? I really can't think of any. Unless it's just man and woman time. But that's a different story. So think about that if you're looking for something to do. Now, what I've done is I did a demo at the FTA that was on raccoons. And I was really surprised because I haven't thought about doing a raccoon demo in so long because fur prices are down. Let's just all be honest. It's not something people are overly excited about. But I went through my spiel, and it was kind of like when I'm thinking about what to do, is like I was going to hold up one of my FB1s or FB2s. You know, everybody know how to use this? Got it? Yeah, we're good. Just kind of toss it over my shoulder. Go to the foothold, you know, do anybody know how to use it? Yep, good, throw it over my shoulder. You know, this is a body grip or a snare or whatever. Yep, we're good, throw it over the shoulder. Then I was gonna go into predator questions and answers. But there was actually quite a few questions on coon, and some of them were pretty intelligent. And then we got into some coyote stuff, and some of those questions I remember that were good that I wanna cover with everybody in case you weren't there. And then, some of the guys that I have asked questions at the booth that I thought was pretty interesting. So I wrote some of these down, and I thought we'd cover these in today's show. So it's going to be covering kind of a gamut here. Now, one of the interesting things that a gentleman asked me at the convention was, he's in a state that cannot use snares, but he's got page wire fences all over the place. So if he could use snares, it'd be ready-made to do like what we do in Texas or what you've seen me do here in Tennessee, where snares are legal. We don't have restrictions about a fence. We don't have any type of goofy laws when it comes to snares. And, you know, it's pretty much just, it's got to be bigger than a 1/16th, and it can't be a spring-thrown snare, kind of like a ram snare pulling over a sapling or something like that. Besides that, we're pretty much open. We don't have cable restraints. We don't have to put a bunch of jewelry on there because some expert somewhere read it in a book and now we got to just buy all this useless crap. We don't have all that stuff. So the fences are there, but he, in his state, he cannot snare. And he did exactly what I've tried to do. I ran out of snares one time in Texas. I had a bunch of footholds, so I started putting the footholds in the crawl unders. And it did not work, and it didn't work for him either. And this was many, many years ago, and I've learned a little bit more about coyotes since then, and I think I understand why it didn't work. And I'm going to kind of go through this with you, because if you're in a state that can't snare but you have crawl unders, guys, you know exactly where the coyotes are going to be. You know where they're at. You don't have to go find the classic trap location. If you see hair in the fence and tracks in the crawl under, or it just looks like it's, if you can't see any sign whatsoever, but it's being used, it's a good chance the next few, 3, 4, 5 days, there's going to be a coyote come through there. When I first started trying to put footholds in the crawl unders, I tried to put them in the deepest part. Every one got fired off. Never caught a coyote. So then I was like, okay, well, that's obviously a loser. So then I'm going to bring it where maybe when they go through the fence and they put their paws on the other side. So I got like 6, 8, 10, 12. I tried all these distances away from the fence. Lo and behold, almost every one of them were fired off. I caught one coyote. And we're talking by numbers. I probably did this 80 to 100 times on this one ranch because I ran out of snares. And that didn't work. So I was like, well, crap. So, and then this gentleman said, because it's amazing when you're working through a problem, you kind of come up with the same things to try to figure out an answer. So if you're going to be in this situation, if you're fine in this situation, do me a favor and learn from my mistakes. Learn from me getting my butt kicked so you don't have to get your butt kicked. That's the value of information. When it comes to something like this, he did, because he brought it up, exactly what I did. So I'm like, okay, they're either rolling under the fence, or they're doing some type of skidding thing, or I don't know exactly what they're doing. So I just went off the side of the crossover, or crawl under, it's not a beaver, crawl under, 3 or 4 foot away, and put in a flat set or a dirt hole set. Out of 80 over about a week, I think I caught two coyotes. Now, I don't think those coyotes were coming under the crawl unders. If you ever get around a big game fence so that there's lots of animals and lots of cover, you will notice that there's a trail normally about 10 inches away from the fence. It goes all the way around the fence. And what happens is animals, depending on where the road's at, the animals will hit the fence and go left or right. And a lot of animals use that as like a border or something, and they mark a bunch of stuff on there. And it's like a feature that they follow, even though it's a fence. So deer do it, coyotes do it, fox do it, cats do it, coons do it. Seen tracks in this trail from all these animals over and over and over again. So the coyotes that I did catch by just moving away from the crawl under 3 or 4 feet was, again, a big fat loser. And I couldn't figure out why. Lo and behold, I got to watch a couple of years later two coyotes come under a fence. The very first time I got to see this, it was a very dry year. It was in, I think this was in George West, if I remember right. And you have a lot of different ground when you get into South Texas. You've got very thick, brushy stuff. And in years of drought, a lot of stuff doesn't sprout. So it looks more like the old cowboy movies where there's not hardly anything there. This was one of those years. And I remember coming up on a hill and I saw movement. And I hit the brakes and just stopped. And sure enough, there were two coyotes. They were not in the same line with each other. And there's crawl unders all around this thing. And they came up to the fence and I got to watch them go under the fence and what they did after they went under the fence. Because, like I've said before, the animal is the ultimate teacher if the student has got the brains to listen to the teacher. Because whatever you want it to be is irrelevant. The coyote's the one in control of this situation. What both of these coyotes did, they're about 15 feet apart. They're just kind of cruising. They get about 5 or 6 feet away from the fence, and they both stop. And you would have thought that they were on a New York City block with a road that they had to cross. Both coyotes did this at the same time. They looked left and right several times, kind of like somebody that's looking, like say you're in combat and you're going to have to do something and you're not going to be able to see what's going around, and you want to see if the bad guy is hidden under a bush or waiting for you behind a tree or something like that. They actually spent about 30, 40 seconds looking back and forth, looking out in front of them. They even looked behind them. And then one made the decision to go under the fence and the other one watched. I bet you the one that went under first was a young one, and the one that didn't go under there first was the older one. But the one that went under the fence, after doing this left and right, looking out in front, looking behind, making sure there's no Indians waiting to scalp them, when he committed to that fence, it was a burst of speed. It was not slow and controlled. It was not at a gentle pace. It was a burst of speed. And then as soon as he got up on the other side, he went about 4 or 5 feet and he repeated the process of looking for the Indians that's going to scalp him. He was nervous. Then the other coyote did exactly the same thing. Then they went on their way. Now I was setting up the fence, so there was no snares in the fence. It would have been really cool to snare the first one and see what the second one did, but that didn't happen. But I got to see them do that, and I thought that was very interesting. Since that time, I've seen a couple other coyotes go through fences that acted the exact same way. And I've seen a coyote go through a low spot in a field, you know, where it's like a drainage ditch that goes through more of a flat field. when they went to one side, they stopped, they looked around, they checked everything out, they looked behind them, they looked left and right to make sure no crazy bus drivers or Indians are waiting for them. And then when they went through that gully, it was at a sure enough almost sprint until they got up to the other side. Now, I'm not a coyote. No matter how much I try to interrogate them, they never give me answers. But this is what I think is happening. I think a coyote understands that when he puts his head down, he can't see anything around him. So it's kind of like putting him in a situation where you're putting a blindfold on an animal that's in Mother Nature, and Mother Nature is brutal. Stuff wants to kill you, attack you. You know, you don't. It's just not a gentle place the way Walt Disney puts it out to be. I think it makes a coyote nervous to have to put their head on the ground and crawl under these fences, because they have to crawl under these. They can't walk under these. So they're completely on the ground, and I think their senses of their surrounding is not at 100%, and it makes them nervous. Just like they're going across a big open field, they can see everything, they're confident, they're strutting, you know, they're owning the world, but when they got to go down in the ditch, they don't know what's coming since they can't see what's outside the ditch because they're in the ditch, and they blow up the other side, and then they want to make sure nothing's about to get them. That's what I think pretty much is happening. It makes sense to me, but there again, I'm not a coyote. I could see that, you know, if you're in a combat situation where you thought some bodily harm could happen and you were going to lose your sense of ability to see and all that, you would not like doing whatever you've got to do because you're vulnerable. Once the coyotes on the other side and they do the whole terrain checkout thing again, then they mosey on the way that they're going. Pretty much in a straight line from the way they came to the way that they went. So that's what I've seen coyotes do. So why do we think that a coyote, me included, because I've done this several times, why do we think if a coyote is doing this, if you put a set 3 or 4 foot away up against the fence, away from that crawl under, that they're going to pay any attention to it at all? They're not. I don't care what lure or bait or what your set looks like or doesn't look like, how natural it is or how cruddy it is, they're not going to stop, because in their mind, it's a very dangerous place. So, like when I was in the military, one of the scariest things that you could do in a real situation was kick in a door. The reason it's scary at the threshold is you don't know what's on the other side of the door and you can't see. Kind of like a coyote putting its head down. So you come through the door. Is there going to be someone waiting on you with a gun? Is there more than one person in the room with a gun? Have they put up booby traps? Have they moved furniture in the way so when you run in there, you're going to trip over and break your neck and they're going to shoot you when you're on the ground? Or the way the Afghanis started doing it, where they're running chicken wire inside the fence so it could open. They could stack everybody up in the chicken wire because they were all running in at the same time. And then they would shoot them because they couldn't get out of the way because they're all packed in the chicken fence. They made a trap out of the door. Now, being a fat boy, I love pizza. I don't eat it very much anymore, but I still love pizza. Now, even as a fat boy that loves pizza, if I was going to have to kick in someone's door that I thought was the threat level was real and high, and sitting right next to the door on a little table was the most beautiful brick oven grilled made meat lover's pizza, fresh out, steaming in the world. Now I want you to keep in mind, I'm going through the door. Now right next to the door is the most beautiful pizza I've ever seen and smelled. Do you think I'm going to pay attention to that pizza going through that door if I'm worried about somebody shooting me? Not a chance. Probably won't see the pizza, probably won't smell the pizza. Because when you go through the door, depending on what unit or what branch you're in, you do a couple of things. And the first one is, first guy goes in, he looks to the left, goes to the corner. Next guy goes in. If there's not a corner, he goes to the first corner on the right. And then you fill in behind them like that. It's a very strategic thing. You know what you're doing. But what you're not doing is eating the pizza as you come through the door, because there could be a bad guy with an AK-47 wanting to add a few extra ounces to you. That's the reason I think that coyotes don't get caught at the fence if they're coming through the fence with a foothold set. So they're not going through a door, they're going in the same situation but under the fence. It's very stressful to them. If you ever see them in action, you'll see that it is not something they enjoy doing. And no matter how beautiful of a set or beautiful of lure you put next to them, they just don't care. So how do we catch them? Well, if you use the habits of the coyotes against them, which a good trapper always will, once the coyote went 4 or 5 feet on the other side of the fence and checked out his whole environment, then they went back to peacocking and strutting and going on down the trail. Once they realized that it was okay, nothing it snuck up on them when their head was down, and they start trotting off down the trail. So if I didn't have snares, or I couldn't set snares, I'm going to go about 30 or 40 feet directly in line, especially if there's a trail, and I'm going to put that set, dirt hole, flat set, blind set, whatever you want to use, 30, 40 feet away from the fence. The cow coming to the fence from the inside of the pasture where the set's going to be, he's not going to be acting all goofy till he gets close to the fence. He knows he's got to put his head down. He'll work the set. If a coyote's coming from outside the pasture through the fence and you've got the trap in line with him and he goes next to it, once he gets out of that little danger zone right there, that coyote's going to act just like a normal cow and probably work the set. So that's where I learned, personally, I'm not saying it's the best or it's the only way, but that's where I learned to still be able to catch coyotes at a fence crossing without being able to set a snare in the fence. Right under the crawl under everywhere was a loser. Next to it was a loser. Let them calm down, get back in their normal mode of safety before you try to get them to work a set, and then lo and behold, you start picking up coyotes. So we talked about that in the demo up there. Now, another one that I was quite amazed, because we've talked about this a couple of times on Trapping Radio, and so I know we're always getting new listeners, and so I'm going to cover this again real quickly. One of them was a guy that's got quail at feeders and stuff like that. He was a professional, like hunting ranch type operation, was at the FTA, and he asked me, I see all these coons on the pictures from the trail cams, and we go put our traps out, the dog proofs, at the feeder, and we catch, you know, two or three the first night, and then they're even on the trail cam, there's no coon that come back there. So if you're new to the show, or you know somebody that's in this situation, are you going to go work for somebody for pay because they want you to catch coons around feeders and stuff like that? This is what's going on, I think. You can definitely catch coon the first night at a feeder. So if you're at a place and you're fur trapping and they have feeders, disregard what I'm getting ready to say. Because I've been on places in Texas that have up to 500 feeders on a ranch between quail and deer. If I was just trying to catch fur on those, I'd go to every single feeder, put out 3 to 4 dog proofs. I'd grab the way I normally do it is I'll grab extension cables, my FB1s. I'll bait them. I will stick them right there next to the feeder. And then I will come back the next day and there'll be 2 or 3 coon caught. Now, if I'm fur trapping, knowing what I know now, I'm going to disconnect the cable. I'm going to take the trap to a new set of feeders and I'm going to repeat that process every single day. You will have an amazing catch till you run out of feeders. And maybe by the time you ran out of feeders, if you're on a big enough ranch, you could start back over and just keep that rolling. Haven't tried it like that, but I'm assuming if you got 10, 12 days in between, it'll probably start working. I believe the reason the coon get caught really easy coming up to the feeder is because it's free food and they're already there and there's no sense of danger with a location. Coons are not smart, but they are not dumb. Coons learn very quickly. That's how they learn how to open up chicken houses and stuff like that. Once they learn a skill or they learn a lesson, they seem to remember it very well. So when the group of coons shows up and a couple of coons get whacked and they're acting funny and strange and they can't get away, a lot of times those coon will almost attack the other coon. I've seen lots of bite marks in those. And they'll all get nervous and they will leave. Now, what are they nervous of? They're now nervous of the location of the feeder. I don't think it's the traps. I think it's the behavior and seeing the other coon get caught and how they act. And you just taught them a lesson. The feeder is, yes, free food yesterday, but today it's going to eat you. They don't understand what the trap is or how it works, but they know that there's something there is going to hurt them or kill them or hold them right at the feeder. They just don't come back. I've seen this countless times. Now, I'm pretty hard-headed. It only took me about 4 years to figure this out. But once I figured it out, not that difficult. So what I told this gentleman, and if you're in this situation, keep this in mind if you're going to be catching raccoons around feeders. Never, ever set the feeder unless you're going to pull the trap the very next day. If you do this, you're sabotaging yourself. Like if you're going out with a kid and you just want to get a quick coon, that's a great thing to do. But if you're getting paid or you're trying to catch a number of coons, you never set the feeder. What you want to do is spend just a few minutes and figure out how the coon are getting to the feeder. Coons are coons and they leave trails, especially at feeders. They'll walk on deer trails. They'll walk around objects. They'll come out of buildings. They'll come out from under cars. If you walk around feeders, you'll be able to tell they're coming down a road. They're doing something to get there. They don't fly in. They didn't parachute in there. They got there somehow. So what your job as a trapper is to figure out how they're coming in there, then go 30, 40 feet away from that feeder and set the traps there. There's no feeder there. There's no free food. There's no reason for that particular location to be different than anything else. If you do this for yourself or for a client, you can catch coon after coon after coon, day after day after day. Now, eventually, the lesson will be taught to the coon that the trail is probably not the safest place to be. But they're not associating that with the feeder. So then they'll start coming different ways. You got to pay attention as you do this if you want to get all the coon. My favorite thing to do with raccoons is to use a drag and let them get away from it a little bit. I found it's better personally in these situations to use a drag. Now I'm using saber tooths and I'm using the saber tooth juniors, which are set up for strictly the juniors are set up for dog proof traps. So and then the way that the Freedom Brand 1 and Freedom Brand 2 are, you can slide those. They hook in there. It's pretty slick how they do that. And you can just set the thing in the drag, set it on the ground, catch a raccoon. But what it allows the coon now to do is to get a little bit away from the trail. So you're not teaching a raccoon a lesson, because now it's just random. And it's much harder for a raccoon to learn a random lesson than it is a very specific lesson. But the main point of this is, if you're around feeders, never set the feeder. You set away from it. And there was other people that's also experienced this. They agreed with me at the FTA, and the guys that didn't were blown away to get this information. See, to me now, this, I'll just assume this was common knowledge, but it's not. So we're re-spreading the knowledge a little bit about that. So if you're around feeders, keep this thing in mind. Another thing that got some comments after my demo was me talking about backfoot catching raccoon in the water. And to the life of me, I know somebody out there is going to email me or something and give me the dude's name, and I'm going to feel like a big dumb butt, because if you'd have woke me up before the FTA at 3 o'clock in the morning and go, who did you learn the raccoon trapping from with the backfoot catch? I could have told you his name, went right back to sleep. But for some reason, I'm in a mental block about the dude's name, and it's driving me nuts, to be honest with you. I'm probably going to have to call Red O'Hearn and go, okay, you went out and saw him, what's his name? Not that it really matters, except I didn't come up with this, and I like to give credit to where credit is due. This is a masterful way to catch raccoons in the water. People were kind of at the demo. They didn't say anything during the demo, but I had several people come up after the demo that were kind of shocked at this concept. If you've ever beaver trapped a lot with bigger traps, you know that beaver have a tendency to find, raccoons have a tendency to find them. And the thing about these bigger traps is they never ever get out of them. And if you're setting them for beaver, the way most people are going to set for beaver, especially if you're using slide wires or bags or something like that where they can't get back to the bank, there's zero damage to the coon at all. Zero, because he stays in the water. Well, the gentleman I'm referring to is from Nebraska. And he had a method of trapping raccoons that I think is the most efficient way to trap raccoons in the water. So if you're going to be setting pockets and stuff, this is such a fast way to catch it. You're not going to catch hardly any mink doing it, or otter for that matter. You will catch a few beaver, but you're not going to catch mink. But he didn't care about mink. Now, back in the early 80s and late 70s when he was doing this, all these guys in the East were becoming famous because they were catching 200-400 raccoons in a season. This gentleman was in Nebraska catching over 1,000 in 20 days. No one knew who he was until Craig O'Gorman put him in his high-rolling coon book. Just some local guys knew him. He didn't write. He didn't do classes. He didn't do any of that till later. So this was the system. You put your trap 6 to 9 inches deep, 6 to 9 inches back from the bank on a high bank, put your pocket in. Then you take the chain, go as deep water as you can. He's using extension. He was using T-bars or wood pickets because apparently the creeks in that part of Nebraska, you could just push them in the ground, they would swell up. Wouldn't work here, may not work where you're at. But just, you're going to have to play. Everybody's got different situations. But the coon never could get out of the water, so he never could chew on his foot, above his foot, once it went numb. So you didn't have that issue. And the coon just had no power because he was in the water. And, you don't have a lot of snap-offs because if you're trapping in somewhat clear water and you put a black trap in clear water up next to a bank in shallow water next to a hole and a coon comes down through there, even at night, that coon is going to see that trap. I promise you he will. Here in Tennessee, our water looks like the Caribbean. Y'all seen videos of it on YouTube. It looks bluish green. It's so clear. You stick a trap right up next to a hole, a coon's going to play with your trap. You move it back in deep, 6-9 inches, 6 and 9 inches. Lo and behold, the coon's just sitting there the next morning. What I like about this system is, and the gentleman that I learned this from through Craig was using 1.5 Victors because that's what everybody used back in the 70s. From doing all the beaver trapping, what I've learned is you can get away with a bigger trap like a number 4 long spring, and you have less damage then than you would with a number 11 long spring, because the coon cannot get it up out of the water. So I shared that at the demo. If you've never heard that before, High Rolling Coon Book from Craig O'Gorman, you'll get the whole system in there. If you're going to be that style of trapper, it really, really rocks. So I thought I'd share that with everybody. Now I want to talk a little bit about paid work. See what our time's doing here. Yeah, I'm probably going to finish up with this. Paid work. Becoming an ADC guy. Getting paid for trapping. That's kind of the holy grail. There was a young man at the show that when he realized that someone paid me to go trapping, he had found his calling in life. He didn't know that that was a possibility. And you could see his brain turning 150% that that's what he wanted to do. Now, I've talked about my story over and over again on this show. I was not the smartest person the way that I went about it. And I suffered financially for several years by the way I went about it. But it got to me where I am today, so I think it was the right thing to do. Even though there was a lot of stress involved going through those years. I don't know if this is because I'm getting older, smarter, or what, but I'm going to talk about this in a little bit different manner. Most guys, when they start becoming known in their area as a trapper, people are going to want you to trap for them. You have a decision to make. Do you want to just trap for fur, or do you want to trap for money, keep the fur, you know, as a bonus? How do you want to do this? Now, I know everybody's first response is, I want to get paid. I get it. I totally get it. And when most people think about being a paid trapper, it's a full-time animal damage control or wildlife control type situation. Here's a different way to look at this. And I don't know what made me think about this, but it was just talking to some other guys at the show that actually were dealers that were trying to do certain things. Anyway, this kind of popped in my head, so I thought this would be an interesting topic to cover. You can go full-time, but there's drawbacks to that. You can go part-time, and there could be drawbacks, but there could be some very big upsides to that, too, that I don't think a lot of people think about, and you never will until you're neck deep into an animal damage control business. So most people, when they want to be a full-time trapper, I get it. They want to be out in the woods all the time setting traps. I totally get that. They want to be their own boss. I live by that. They want to have some freedom. I totally understand that too. So they start becoming a skilled trapper. They start getting recognized. They start having people willing to pay them to go trapping. And then they start making, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60, sometimes 100% of their job income as a part-time thing. If you hate your job, it could be a little bit different. But a lot of people do things that they actually somewhat enjoy for other people as far as work. A lot of people got some really nice paying, no work jobs. There's a lot of guys that get paid just to ride around in trucks and be a manager. And they make good money. Now, if you're a ditch digger and, you know, in the middle of the summer with a shovel and it's 110 degrees and you're about to pass out from dehydration, you may not look at the same site the same way. So be realistic about what it is you do. If you have an office job that's not that stressful, you're making good money, maybe you should look at your trapping in a little bit different way, which I want to bring up some points. You start getting close to where you're making as much in your part-time as you're in your full-time. You want to go full-time. You're excited about going full-time. I totally get that. You probably don't understand, unless you've done a lot of studying, that you need to make 1.5 times the income as a business owner, as an employee, because the government takes way more of it away from you. So if you're equal in your lifestyle set on that equal pay, you're going to be losing ground. Just keep that in mind, because that's reality. So if you're making $50,000 a year and you want to go full-time, make sure you can make $75,000. That way, at least you have the same lifestyle. But something happens when you go full-time that people getting to the full-time stage don't quite get until they fall into what Charles Dobbins used to talk about as a trapper setting a trap for himself. when your livelihood depends on you trapping, you find yourself doing things you don't want to do. Working for people you don't want to work for. Putting up with their rules that makes your life miserable. There are a lot of buttholes out there that need trappers. They have money. Some don't really want to pay. Some don't care to pay. Some want you to do things that are borderline that you could get in some big trouble for. There's a lot of things that will tempt a full-time guy that will never tempt a part-time guy. I've had clients in Kyle work that I have worked for several years till I found better clients, and I hated being there. I did not like them. I did not like the rules. I did not like the ground I was trapping at. And it because of all that do not likes, the job was miserable. But I had to, because I had to provide money for the household. Because I was full time. Let that sink in a little bit. When you're relying on income as a trapper, a lot of times you do things you really don't want to do, and you would be better off doing something that you really don't care about, but it's a soft job and you make pretty good money at. Now, on the other hand, if you've got a job that you absolutely just don't hate, and you know, everybody says they hate their job, and I mean, there's some people out there pretty slick jobs. But you can go and generate a lot of extra money trapping part-time. That's a totally different sphere to be in. Because if you're, say, making $50,000 at a job that's not driving you absolutely insane, and you make another $30,000, now you're up to $80,000. That's just extra money. That's just go buy some toys, go on vacation, go out to dinner, buy more traps, pay off a car, you know, get your house paid off, do some investing in some property or real estate or something like that. That could be a life-changing thing that happens to somebody where someone's full-time. A lot of times they're going to struggle because now it's just burn rate of what they got to spend every month to stay afloat. The other thing is you have a better opportunity with a little bit of self-discipline and not be greedy about it, is to pick who your clients are and what you're doing. There's a lot of guys that love to beaver trap. There's a lot of guys that loathe beaver trapping. There's a lot of guys that don't mind beaver trapping in the winter, and they hate to do it in the summer, because in some parts of the country you're dealing with snakes and alligators, and it's hot and it's muggy, and you're catching turtles all the time, and there's just, it's not the most glorious thing to do is catch beaver in the summertime. Especially in the South. Maybe it's different in Canada. I don't know. But if you don't like doing it in the summer and it's part-time, it's really easy to go, yeah, I don't think I'm interested. You cannot do that a lot of times if you're depending on all income to keep things afloat. So by being part-time and banking extra money to do things with, guys, please don't waste it, but do some really nice stuff with, you can pick what you want to do that you may not have the options as a full-time guy. The other thing is, when you come across clients that are peckerheads, and they're overbearing, and they want to be super cheap, and they're always trying to, you know, beat you down on price, if it's not something you're relying on, no thank you, sir, I think we're good. I'll move on, and you need to find yourself another trapper. Now, see, I'm at that stage kind of right now for what trapping I do for predator control. I've got certain clients. I've got certain things that I do. Do people call? I'm not interested. They're going to have to tempt me with something really spectacular to get me to move. Because I'm not super dependent on that money anymore. My money basically comes from the supply side. That switched over time, so I'm not dependent. So now the predator control part is actually a part-time gig, money-wise, and the full-time is putting stinky stuff in bottles. That's the full-time. So that's the job. So when you're making this decision and you start thinking about becoming a, quote, professional trapper, don't let that term, don't let your ego get involved with this. What is better for your particular situation? Yeah, you're going to work more hours with a full-time and then still doing some part-time stuff. It's okay, you'll miss a little bit of TV. Then you may have some stuff on landowners that when fur prices do come up, you can have a lot of really cool relationships that's more based off friendship than it is just strictly the dollar bill, which will pay off in huge ways down the road a lot of times. It's just a different way of looking at it. Plus, if you're dependent on money and someone's lowballing you on price and you know you've got bills coming up and you know that, you know, you've got doctor bills or you've got to put gas in the truck and the car insurance is coming up and all this, you're almost forced a lot of times to do work below value because you need what money you can get. As a part-time guy, and they start lowballing you, appreciate the offer, it's not enough. If you change your mind, let me know. It's simple. You're not tempted to do things you normally wouldn't do for money because you don't need it for the same reasons. It's just gravy. Gravy's good, but you don't want to pay twice as much for it through labor to get the value. Anyway, I just thought that would be something interesting to think about if you're thinking about going into the paid part of trapping. It's really cool to get paid for trapping. I'm not discouraging anybody from that. I do think a lot of people would be more happy with it as part-time than trying to struggle with it as a full-time. But that's up to you to figure that out. Like I said, don't let your ego, what other people think, you know, because it's always, yeah, I'm a full-time trapper. Hell yeah, I am. I'm a man. Not if you're struggling all the time. This ain't quite as manly fun as you thought it was going to be. But if it's all gravy, you wanted to pay for an elk hunt every year to go get on a horse and be a cowboy, that's pretty cool to do that. And as we close, just keep in mind, guys, deer season is going to be here before you know it. If you want to start training your deer to make your trails for you and where they come at such a regular basis, you'll start having names for them. Get you some tactical nuke, pawpaw, screaming apple. Mix that in with your corn. Do not put this stuff around trees that you're trying to grow, like in an orchard, because the deer will tear the world up when you start putting this stuff out there. But you can start training your deer to be where you want them to be when it's time to harvest the deer. Some will say that that's not sportsman. That's okay. I'm meat hunting. I'm not ashamed of that one bit. But even with bucks, you can get them coming in. You can get their trail picks. You can get their habits down, because they will come in with tactical nuke way more than they will with just straight corn. Test it out for yourself. You'll see that's the truth. So, guys, I will talk to y'all next week. And hopefully, I will see some of y'all, or most of y'all. It'd be nice to see all of y'all. It'd be the biggest convention in history to see everybody at the Springfield MTA in Missouri in this month. All right, guys. Talk to y'all later.